Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, James Holland, and John McManus. How are you, John?
Hey, how's it going, Al? Hey, Jim. How are things?
How are you?
Great.
Well, they're a little bit, I'm feeling a little bit frazzled, but just seem to be going hither than thither everywhere at the moment. But no, broadly speaking, okay. And working out some very interesting things about the Germans at Anzio and Monte Cassino, which has been fascinating.
Good. Excellent. And John, your term's just coming to a close, and then you're off to a conference, right?
Yeah, it is. So I'm giving final exams this week, and then also going down to New Orleans to the World War II Museum for their international conference. Yeah, that's
amazing.
Coming up the end of this week. As you know, Jim, that's a blast. That's so much fun.
Yeah, it is. It's always really good. Who's going this year? Who are your mates?
Let's see. Craig Simons, I think, is going to be there.
Oh, I'll send him my best.
Absolutely. Will do. Kara Viewick will be there.
Alex Ritchie
will be there. That's right. Yeah, looking forward to seeing her. Don Miller is going to talk about the making of Masters of the Air, which, of course, is going to be really cool. I think Keith Lowe is going to be there.
Oh, great.
Yeah. It should be a pretty good crew.
Oh, we'll have a great time. Send them all my best.
Yeah, we'll do. Absolutely.
Now, John, we haven't spoken in a little while. The last time we talked was about Tarawa, which was extremely well received by the listeners. And I've been poking around looking at British medicine, combat medicine, and I thought I wanted to pick your brains, talk to you about the subject of that on the other side of the pond, and what the Americans are doing in terms of their combat medicine, where they've got to, what they're trying to achieve, who the movers and shakers are, and all that sort of stuff.
And also how they organise it on the battleground, because you always have a lot about corps men and stuff, but how do they fit in, and what's the number per platoon or whatever? How does it all work?
So to start us off, what do they bring from the First World War in this regard? Because obviously, like the British have had a go, and have some sort of vestigial systems left in place that they then build on. Are the Americans sort of doing the same thing, that they've got the way they did it last time around, and they're gonna kind of do that again and with refinement?
Yeah, they're kind of focused on three things: disease prevention, of course, which is obviously always in play, but especially a hangover from the Spanish flu pandemic, that happens during and after World War I. They're always thinking about battlefield first aid. How they can efficiently treat casualties and get them to excellent medical care as quickly as possible. They have a very good sense of how this needs to be done. And then third, dealing with shell shock or combat fatigue or whatever we're going to call it, and sort of on the cusp of the war, their answer to that is we didn't pick up all these defects in guys in World War I who ended up with shell shock, who just weren't, constitutionally wired to be there. So let's prevent it on the front end. So they were, as the draft amps up before U.S. entry into World War II, they were rejecting something in the order of about one out of every three potential inductees, either for some kind of physical malady, but often for a perceived psychological problem. Of course, as you guys know, this didn't work at all. And a lot of these same folks came back into the cycle later and served. But so there was a bit of a three-pronged approach before the war as to how they felt. They would work medicine when and if they got involved in World War II.
But it's fascinating, isn't it, that they're trying to anticipate potential combat fatigue cases before they've actually happened. I mean, how can you possibly know? you get combat fatigue because you've been in combat too long. So obviously, if you don't go into combat, you should be all right.
Well, and because they were thinking of it as shock, like shell shock. So why are you shocked and I'm not? And what is it about us? And of course, it's an era where there's this belief where people are constitutionally prone to things, whether racial ideas or whatever. That's a kind of popular notion that you and I know it's a matter of fatigue, that if we're at Anzio for 60 straight days getting pounded by Anzio Annie, you know, it's going to have its effect, right? I mean, I don't think they have as good an understanding of that as much as they studied World War One, and obviously had experienced it. I don't think they were drawing something of the right lessons, and they even weren't at the beginning of World War Two, because how they're treating it changes in the course of the war.
Well, and it's as much to do with the fact that psychiatry is sort of relatively new, isn't it? As pushed through in the 20s and the 30s, you've got lots of Freudian people, you know, that those ideas are very much in the fore in psychiatry. And so there's a sort of ideas in there that if you've had something terrible happen to you in your childhood, Battleshock will revive that memory and make you have a breakdown, rather than someone is trying to kill you over and over again, which is solid enough for a human psyche to be getting on with, as well as that time your dad told you off or whatever it is that's supposedly lurking in your psyche. I mean, it's of its time, isn't it? That, as you say, John, it's completely of its time and goes with the psychiatry of the time, the thinking, the smart thinking. And they're disabused of that very, very quickly, of course, aren't they? But, you know, they weed out. I mean, it's millions of people are turned down on the grounds that they probably haven't got the nerve. They haven't got the right stuff. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, that's a great point, Al, that psychiatry and psychology, which is confusingly is much the same thing, but psychiatry, the difference is you would have had a medical degree. So you'd be, you know, a little more on the physical side, I guess, too. But yeah, I mean, they're all over the place in terms of how they treat mental illness or emotional issues or whatever. And so they couldn't agree among themselves. And there aren't that many mental health professionals. There's not that much commitment to it. They're not even sure that's where it belongs as things go on. I mean, because it is fatigue once we have, you know, World War II going on. I mean, it's really interesting how this happens. Now, they also think that there are like character defects that are going to be a problem once you serve, and that we can figure out in a pre-induction physical where a physician sits down with you and asks you a series of questions, and somehow we can determine you're not fit for service somehow. And partly what they're looking to do too, honestly, is to weed out gay people, because they believe that's some sort of deficiency. And, you know, I mean, they even say it.
God, you can just imagine the questions, can't you?
Yeah, like one of which is, do you like girls? And, you know, and so some people take it as a joke, like, well, of course, duh, you know, because to them, they would have never considered anything otherwise. Other people, you could imagine that'd be a very uncomfortable question. So it's of course, many, many, many decades before we begin to understand someone's sexual orientation doesn't have a thing to do with how courageous you are or what kind of soldier you can be or whatever. Nothing. But in the 30s, I mean, of course not. They don't really get that.
Or what they think of their mother or any of those things.
Because, yeah.
Because at the other end of it, certainly the British Army, they ask those kind of questions to gauge people's propensity to aggression and what kind of soldier they're going to be in the airborne end of things. They ask them those kind of questions as well, because they're trying to find the aggressive people. And if you're too fond of your mum or whatever, they'll decide.
Mummy's boy.
Exactly. They'll decide you're unsuitable. You're not going to be sufficiently aggressive. But basically, everyone's groping around in the dark looking for answers here, to which there probably aren't any, is the truth.
I mean, the big sort of middle point is the slapping in Sicily, isn't it?
with Patton? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and that guy's got, well, it turns out he's got malaria, the first guy, doesn't it? But he's in there and he says to Patton that he just feels a bit tired and that doesn't wash. But when are things starting to change on that kind of psychology side of things?
Oh, I think very early in the war. There is a sense that, you know, there aren't that many mental health professionals. So if we have a division size unit, we're lucky to have maybe two somewhere in play. Yeah, I mean, very early on, at Guadalcanal, at Buna, wherever, they're figuring out, hey, we've got a problem here. You know, these folks have passed through all of these, you know, all the training we've had, they've been determined suitable to fight and all this, and yet we're still ending up with combat fatigue cases. What do we do? And the crisis point in the Pacific, I would argue, happens in the Battle of New Georgia in the middle of 1943, when the 43rd Infantry Division.
So it's the same time, actually, isn't it?
Roughly the same time as what's happening with Patton and Sicily, or you know, almost the exact same month. The 43rd Division goes into combat really not prepared for what they're about to face, especially the night dimension to fighting.
Right.
And so they really, many of them get very psyched out by the conditions, the Japanese. There's these sort of apocryphal stories that the Japanese have these kind of samurais in robes roaming the lines at night with swords, chopping people's head off and everything. So there's a number of guys who are just completely breaking down. And so the 43rd is evacuating thousands of guys initially. And their viewpoint is these guys are shattered. They're done. We can't do much with them. So where the turning point is that they figure out, you know what, we can treat people and we can send them back and they're going to be better off for it. And also we've been way too lenient on what we're diagnosing as combat fatigue. It could just be, I'm really frightened out of my wits for a couple hours. And,
right.
You know, and if I have good leadership, then I'm going to be sort of point in the right direction.
And with combat fatigue, the symptoms tend to chase after the expected symptoms, don't they? So you know, people, if it's reported that you'll get off if you go mute, people go mute, and if you go deaf, people go deaf, and the symptoms sort of follow the diagnosis in a very, very strange way because it's a psychological condition. The British get quite sensitive to that quite quickly, and they also, I mean, I always think there's a parallel with how they deal with malaria. In the British Army, the way you deal with malaria is you do it as forward as you can because you don't want people coming right out the line. You don't want to waste time bringing people out the line and sending them back to where you might never get them back from. That what you do is, you know, these forward treatment areas they have for malaria are not unlike the forward treatment that the British do for people with combat fatigue, where, you know, you're basically given sedatives and made to sleep for 48 hours, given a clean uniform, given a good meal. The psychiatrist talks to you and then you're given a pat on the back and sent back to your unit because you've had a kip, you know, basically. Yeah. You've caught up on your sleep because it is so tied up with exhaustion, they find in the sort of most cases, don't they? Rather than people have actually completely crumbled.
And it's completely understandable, isn't it? I mean, we've all been really tired and you just get ratty and short, you know, and a bit emotional and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
In a way that you don't if you're feeling completely on top of the world. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because a lot of the psychological side of things and sort of keeping an eye on people was done, certainly the British Army, by the battalion commander, his number two, and the padre that was attached.
Yeah.
You know, so the padre, whether you were the men in your battalion were regiment, field artillery, company, whatever. The padre had a pastoral role which sort of went beyond sort of holding church services in fields. And certainly with the Sherwood Rangers, you know, Padre Skinner and Stanley Christopherson and Stephen Mitchell, his number two for much of that period in the last year of the war, you know, they would just keep an eye on people. And if they felt that someone just nerves were starting to fray a little bit, they'd whip them out and make them intelligence officer for a bit or put them into B echelon for a while or send them on a course. Or, you know, that was another classic, you know, so you go and do a course back home for a week or something, you know, completely pointless, but would just give you a chance for a break and a change. I mean, is that sort of thing going on in the U.S. Army as well?
Well, so much as it could. I mean, it's personnel management, usually when there's good leadership that can observe such things or has the luxury of doing so. But if we're in Hurtgen Forest for 10 to 14 meat grinding days, I don't know that we have that luxury anymore. And it's just sort of mass CAS kind of thing. But I do think there's much the same kind of role for the clerics. I mean, Jim, I think that's a great point because a chaplain during World War II is kind of a medic on some levels. That's where he's spending a lot of his time. I mean, you know what I mean? And so it's like, and it certainly that means being a mental health professional in terms of counseling and being there for soldiers, but also on the physical side too. You know, you spend a lot of your time at the aid station or at the field hospital or working with the wounded or helping evacuate them or blessing the wounded or whatever. It's so, yeah, it's interesting. So you see the faith and you see the sort of science side of it too.
Yeah, that's a really good point because actually I forgot to mention Dr. Hilda Young. His nickname was Hilda, but he was the MO, the medical officer for the Sherwood Rangers. And him and Padre Skinner were super tight. I mean, they were just absolutely in each other's pockets. And Skinner would physically help with the medical stuff. And Hilda Young would help Padre Skinner with the kind of more pastoral side of things. So, you know, obviously one had a bias of influence. But they were both kind of working together. So it sounds to me like it's a very similar model, really.
But this depends, of course, on officers, you know, to the extent to which they believe in combat fatigue and all that sort of thing, don't they? You know, which brings us all the way around back to Patton, you know, that some officers are conservative in their view of this whole thing, that it's malingerers and cowardice and all that sort of stuff. And of course, in the interwar years, that's what a medic does in a, you know, in peacetime, that's what a regimental medical officer does in the British Army. You know, he's the guy you go to see to if you've, you know, if you think you've got a sore throat or whatever, or you think you need to be excused duties. That changes once you're in action, obviously. But, you know, if you've got a conservative regimental commanding officer who doesn't believe in any of this, he's putting people on charges rather than getting them well, right? Yeah?
I mean, too often, yeah. But that's going to happen probably, you know, early on, and then it's left behind. I mean, pretty soon, I would say institutionally, the U.S. Army, the U.S. Navy... because they've been thinking about it in the interwar period too. So I think you do certainly have these kind of dinosaurs who are you know, unsympathetic, but I think they're getting pressure from above institutionally in the armed forces that this has to be treated and dealt with. So Patton, in that sense, is a bit of an outlier, I think. And of course, maybe he's not a good example because he's pretty senior versus, say, a battalion, a regimental commander, or a company commander who might affect us maybe a little bit more as a soldier. But, you know...
Yes, he's not having to do that kind of man management directly, is he? That's the thing.
No, and it just sort of happens to come out, in his case, with a couple of anecdotal encounters in a hospital where he's going. You know, this is a kind of interesting to remember that, I mean, he's going there to help the wounded and help them psychologically, ironically. I mean, isn't that what any general's there for? I mean, he's not a doctor. And of course, this couldn't have been easy for him or any other general to encounter the results of what he had ordered. And so there were some generals who just could not go and visit. There were others like him, like Simon Bolivar Buckner, who just, you know, haunted the hospitals in a way because they felt that was a big part of what they ought to be doing, to their credit, I think. But we don't know how we'd react until we're there as a senior officer, right? And you know, so Patton himself, some people think, you know, Patton himself might have been suffering from combat fatigue in some levels too. I don't know. Or maybe just exhaustion. Yeah. Who knows?
Do you think this development in the understanding of combat fatigue, do you think that's bottom up or is that top down or is it a bit of both?
It is a bit of both because the Army and the Navy have been thinking about it a lot in the interwar period from the experience of World War I, especially the Army, of course. And then, of course, the war begins and we're confronted with the realities of this. And we're constantly on the fly trying to figure out how we're going to treat folks. How are we going to deal with this? And this is still true. Is this a physical problem? Is it a mental problem? Is it an emotional problem? What's really going on here? And it's kind of all the above on some levels, isn't it? I mean, I personally think in my own kind of non-professional way, you know, we talked about exhaustion. I wonder if this is a byproduct of sleep deprivation. Like you said, Jim, when you're really tired, you know, your motor skills now are not as good. You're cranky. You're not the same person. And I wonder in combat, you know, we're just not sleeping the way we ought to be. And we're lucky to get 3 hours a night.
It's just unbelievable, isn't it? I just think people don't appreciate enough how much sleeping patterns are totally knocked on the head by war. You know, I mean, just take a fighter pilot in the Battle of Britain. You know, you're going to bed late because you're young and you're going to the pub and getting pissed and what have you. And then you're getting up at sort of crack of dawn, which in July is very early and so by September is a little bit later. You're snatched, you know, you're getting maybe 3-4 hours a night and then you're kind of snatching it during the day on deck chairs. Well, that's not ideal, is it? And you know, ditto in kind of Normandy. I mean, you know, sleeping in a hole.
What kind of sleep is that?
Well, the very long days in the midsummer in Normandy do not help, do they? You know, it's dawn at 4, isn't it? And gets dark at sort of 10 o'clock at night. So you've no time at all, really. You're fighting every hour that daylight sends. John, the thing I wanted to ask, though, to just move on a touch, is we've talked a lot on Between Us about how in 1939, there's a tiny US army. You know, it's an imperial force in the Philippines where it's officers running local soldiers. And then there's a sort of think tank border force sort of thing in the US itself. I'm assuming that the US Army Medical Department has to go through exactly the same kind of colossal expansion. But obviously, they're dependent on a very highly trained manpower in the form of doctors. So what do they do? How do they get the people?
So you have this kind of skeleton of what's going to become an entirely fleshed out body. So both the Army and the Navy had very well-developed, very consistent medical corps with physicians and nurses, and the infrastructure was there. So what they had in place by 1939 was appropriate to the smaller peacetime force. Once they mobilize, partially what they're going to be doing is, of course, recruiting young doctors from every walk of residency and interning and medical schools. I mean, if you are a medical, somebody in the medical pipeline in 1942-ish or whatever, I mean, there's a very good chance you're going to end up in uniform, regardless of how old you are. But if you're under 45, oh my gosh, you know, I mean, there's one exception to this, though, that I should point out, which sort of dovetails what we discussed with Matthew Delmont recently. If you were an African-American nurse or something like that, no, we don't want you because of the color of your skin. You know, so again, here's the sort of luxury of our racism in a way, that black nurses have to basically beat down the doors to get in to the armed forces, even as we have a nurse shortage. You know, it's absurd. But these were something of the reality. So there's also a major recruiting effort to get women who, you know, most nurses were women, to get women to volunteer, because you couldn't draft them the way you could male medical professionals.
Yeah.
So there's an enormous kind of coast to coast effort to get white nurses to go and sign up, with some level of success. The other thing they're doing sometimes is transporting, like, lock, stock and barrel hospitals or whatever in civilian life into military life. An example I'll give you is the 20th General Hospital, which is basically medical personnel from the University of Pennsylvania and a local hospital there in Philadelphia. Everyone who could serve conceivably is basically going to be transitioned into uniform, introduced to military life, and continue with the same job that they had done in civilian life that now is going to be done in military life. They serve in Lido in India. And they're their main hospital that you would have as for your medical care if you're in Burma in 1944 or even before. You know, so you have that too. The other thing at a lower level, and this is what fascinates me to this day, is, of course, as you're mobilizing millions of young men into military service, you're figuring out MOSs for them, aren't you? So in some cases, they are tapping young men who have entered basic training or whatever to be medics, to be the, you know, like the field medics, the combat medics. And like, how do they do that? And part of it is just this sort of introductory psychological makeup or whatever. This person seems to be a caregiver. I'll give you an example from a later era, but it adheres to this too. One of my friends was a combat medic with the 1st Cavalry Division in Vietnam. And, you know, he went through basic training like everybody else. And he always wondered, why did they send me to Fort Sam Houston to become a medic? And it turned out he was perfect for it. He was very good at it. And he thinks that on the survey that they gave him, his answer to the question, if you're driving, you know, on a dark road and you saw an animal, would you brake or would you simply run over the animal and go on your way? He said he would break. He would, you know, try and save the animal. He felt that answer was why they slotted him to be a medic. I don't know, but it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Why me? That's fascinating. What was it about me? God, that's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
But there were conscientious objectors as well. So because you know, after all, Desmond Doss is the you know, incredibly famous corporal in the army, who saves all sorts of people, you know, scores of people's lives, doesn't he? It's the most extraordinary story. He's a conscientious objector, isn't he? So they're doing that too. So they're gravitating to the role too, right?
Definitely. Yeah. If you were a conscientious objector, there's a very good chance you're ending up on the medical side of the house. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. But even for many who weren't, you know, there were some people, maybe the way they score on the Army General Classification Test, you know, with maybe better answers to anything possibly medical. I mean, who knows? It's a mishmash of personalities, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll take a very quick break, then we'll come back. This is, as ever, fascinating stuff. We'll see you in a tick.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Caddy, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, where Jim, John, and I are talking about medicine in the US Army.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Go on, Jim.
Well, so what I remember when I was doing all that work on Normandy, I remember that one in four battlefield casualties were being returned to the battlefield by Normandy by the US Medical Corps. And that was considered a really high rate. I mean, you know, just sort of groundbreakingly good. And the frontline American troops were getting arguably the best medical care anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And I suppose, how do they get there? What are they doing? And how much is the armed forces in the war part of the kind of sort of pioneering development of global medicine, but certainly medicine in the USA?
Absolutely.
And penicillin, the importance of penicillin, of course.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, from the War Department on down, there is an enormous commitment in the United States to getting the best medical care for service people. So the entire military infrastructure is set up to reflect that. And you're at a moment in history where medical knowledge is such that now this is possible. Yet disease prevention can really be done on many levels. Now, to be sure, we lose some people to disease. But when you consider previous times in history, the loss to disease is fairly small. And also, there's been a lot of lessons learned from World War I on good battlefield medicine and care, what works, what doesn't, how you can evacuate people. Of course, you know, Jim, as we've talked, like the vehicles. Vehicles are going to help you with this too, how we evacuate people. The new element of aviation to this too, the idea of flight nurses and flight medical personnel to evacuate wounded and care for them and treat them. All of this.
Yes, and they're doing that a lot in the Far East, aren't they?
And
tons. In the Pacific. A lot of these little planes that come down. I can't remember what they're called.
Oh, you've got the smaller ones like the L5s and all that maybe are going to be playing Leyte and Luzon. That we got one or two bad casualties deep in the hills and come down to land and get them out. Merrill's Marauders, that in Burma too. But more commonly, let's say it's Saipan or something. We've got 40 wounded guys and we've got three planes that we can C-47s or whatever that are specially fitted. We can evacuate them back to Oahu, to better medical structure there, maybe back to the West Coast or maybe to Australia, wherever it happens to be. You've got that in play, too, and a commitment toward it, because you could have just had no commitment to it and saying we need planes for combat. The hell with them. So instead, it's here is a major priority for us. To give the absolute best medical care. So any unit, really, no matter the orientation of the unit, probably has a medical dimension, like a medical detachment, and often with an actual physician, but if not that, a medical tech of some kind who's right there with us, whether it's engineering, signals, you name me an MOS, there's a medical dimension to it right down to that grassroots level.
But there's a pragmatic reason for this, isn't there? Because you want to get guys back in the combat zone.
Yeah.
But there's also a morale issue, which is,
yeah. Yes.
If how are you getting all these Americans to fight in an atoll in the middle of the Pacific or up Monte Altuzzo on the Gothic Line? You know, what is it that's driving them? Well, one of the key things is to make sure that, of course, as we've just talked before, that morale is absolutely as high as it possibly can be, all things considered. And knowing that you've got medical support is obviously a key factor in that.
It's huge. I mean, that is a big part of morale. It's a big part of what you expect as an American citizen that has now drafted you to go to every corner of the globe. Now, the least they could do is give you decent medical care and preparation, too, in that sense. So it's and also, you know, there's an attempt to train soldiers in first aid, though, as we all know, you're kind of dissuaded from stopping to help your buddy because the medics are supposed to be doing that. But we all know that's not always practical. So you would have had some training toward that, too, even as an average soldier. And so it's really quite ubiquitous that the whole medical orientation to these armed forces, I think, is a fascinating aspect of this because of what it communicates, that the average person and their physical body matters. It matters to the government, certainly pragmatically and maybe cynically, to recover them to continue the fight. Yes. But on a bigger societal level, the expectation that they must have this commitment that the individual matters and that the government needs to commit some resources to that.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it, that the tension between, or the way that those are two ideas that aren't in opposition to one another, but at least they're in tension. The idea that what the army wants is it wants you back and it wants you fixed because it needs to use you because you, you know, but also what the state has to do is show that it cares. And the fact that these are able to work in sync and that medics, lots of the medics must know that the cynical argument for their presence, which is to patch men up and make them useful again, but are also medics because they're caring people. So there's this permanent, I mean, in a way, Joseph Heller writes about that in Catch 22, you know, about the way he just talks about medicine and that, because Yossarian has this ongoing relationship with the field hospital there. I mean, what the figures around this are extraordinary. It's 50,000 doctors recruited into the, you know, 83 women as well, which I think is really interesting. 15,000 dentists. The Army Nursing Corps expands from 1,000 nurses to 52,000. And they're all commissioned as officers by June of 44, the nurses, which I think is really interesting. And you've got 1,500 dietitians, physical therapists.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. And one of the figures I stumbled over, though, because you talked about disease earlier on, out of 918,298 men treated, the numbers in this article I'm reading say only 585 U.S. soldiers died of disease.
In the entire World War II?
That's what it says here, which strikes me.
I mean, it's probably larger than that.
I imagine it is because you've got malaria, but they're saying, this article's saying 700 malaria patients dying. You know, I mean,
from across the whole of the Pacific, that sounds.
I think there's more than that in the macro picture, but yeah. Maybe in that particular 900,000 sample,
yeah,
but that would be kind of representative, sure.
Which is amazing.
Oh, it is,
isn't it?
From this thing from coming from a small sort of skeleton structure into a thing that can actually deliver on these gigantic numbers. I mean, the British Army's what, 78,000 people now. That's a pretty good rate, isn't it? Delivery health-wise.
But it's amazing when you contrast this with the German approach, you know, and that sort of incredibly cavalier kind of, you know, if they've got a stomach, we just let them die, that kind of approach.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming back to my great hero, Hedley Verity, who gets wounded in the plain of Catania, and he dies because he's picked up by the Germans and he gets German medical care as opposed to being picked up. And, you know, had he been picked up by the British, that shoulder wound with a sort of cracked rib pressing on his lung and all the rest of it, it wouldn't have gone gangrenous because they had penicillin by that point. He'd have probably been shipped back to a field hospital, dealt with pretty quickly, given tetanus jabs and penicillin, then put on a boat to Malta and it'd have been absolutely fine. It's because he's travelled to Caserta in really bad conditions. You know, he's operated on not very effectively. It goes bad. He dies of septicemia, effectively. Well, he dies of massive hemorrhage, but I mean, brought on by septicemia. That's because he's unfortunate enough to be picked up by the Germans.
And in the case of the Germans, of course, on the eve of the war, they have some of the best medical knowledge on the planet. I mean, there's no problem there. The problem is now under stress in this massive war, which is crushing their manpower and everything else, and also
and supplies.
Exactly that, and just the nature of the Nazi regime, caring nothing for anybody, really, any person on any individual level. All of this creates that kind of perfect storm. Whereas I think, you know, what you see on the Allied side, the Western Allied side, is certainly already the similar kind of medical knowledge and infrastructure there, now expanded toward a military purpose, just as we've seen maybe our automation in play, our engineering know-how or whatever. Well, here's the medical side, and then that kind of societal commitment, not just the U.S., but Britain, Canada, Australia, you know, to getting good medical care to the soldiers, so much as that's possible. This is a tremendous commitment, and the Americans are really quite stunned when they see otherwise in their enemies, certainly the Japanese, who are under tremendous crisis and don't have the same kind of medical infrastructure. They're amazed at how they're horrified, honestly, at the paucity of care, but also among their allies in China, for instance. You know, a wounded soldier in many cases during the war is sort of looked down upon as useless and is deliberately mistreated in a way so that the person will die. And it's the Americans can't understand that. Of course, all this is happening in the context of what the Chinese are suffering, which is a much more horrible war than the Americans could ever envision. And they don't have the luxury of the resources and whatever. And so it's really the Americans are kind of, when they're looking at the medical care side of it, they come into the war with these assumptions that everybody must have this. It's almost similar to their food, you know, oh, everybody must eat this way. And it's not that way. I mean, so, you know, and I think that's quite disillusioning, but also eye opening for many. Yeah. You know, in the course of the war.
Well, I remember this quote by John Slessor, later Air Chief Marshal John Slessor. And at the time, he's number two in Italy, the Air Forces in Italy. And he's complaining about Allied soldiers. And he's saying, you know, a German soldier can survive for 4 days what an American, British soldier would expect to have for one. You know, we've just got to be tougher and harder and more like the Germans. But he's wrong. You know, he's just plain wrong about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's nothing to be proud about, that you're expecting your German troops to survive off literally nothing. I mean, that's a really bad thing. You want them to be fed decent, balanced food. Now, you know, K rations and stuff are notoriously boring, but the whole point is to have balanced food. You know, you get your protein, get your fiber, get your vitamin C and all the rest of it. And that's what they're doing. So there's much more care on that front. And of course, it's the Americans that are pioneering these ration cases, the cave rations and different types of ration boxes you get with that balance of nutrients that you need on a daily basis and calories and all the rest of it. I can't remember the name of the doctor, but
Ansel Keys is the guy, and there's a lot of research that goes into the creation of those cave rations.
Yeah, it's not just sort of randomly picked upon, is it? I mean, it's all very carefully thought out. It's not about being tasty. It's about being functional.
Yeah.
Just for the K rations, that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting because I was talking to someone the other day who's just sort of picked up from a shipwreck off the Philippines 60,000 Coca-Cola bottles. But that's important to American troops.
Absolutely.
That you can have that, and that on your naval ship you get ice cream and all this kind of stuff.
John, on the supply side, how are they? Are they doing big blood drives back in the U.S.?
Oh, huge.
How's that working?
Absolutely. Yeah, great point, Al. So blood drives are such a big part of this because as the war, I mean, they already knew coming in, but as the war unfolds, they're getting a very good sense of how important plasma was, of course, for first aid, but specifically whole blood. Because the number one cause of death in combat wounded tended to be bleeding out. So as that proceeds, that's one thing the American public can do is to help our service people overseas by donating blood. So I'll give you just a sort of microcosmic example. One of the most iconic baseball broadcasters at the time was a guy named Red Barber, who was the broadcaster for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Barber led in the course of the war multiple blood drives among his radio audience in the New York City area, not just Brooklyn, but also it spread beyond that. Barber became very, very well known for raising untold amounts of blood that who knows how many lives that would have saved. I mean, that's what he dedicated his life to doing during World War II.
So did they freeze it and then send it overseas?
They do, exactly. So now that here we come to the equipment, you could refrigerate it properly and you could transport it such that it could be used. So all of this is part of the whole sort of logistical administrative side of the war that we were constantly talking about, that now this is possible. I mean, maybe you could have had somebody getting the word out about a blood drive in the 19th century, but as to whether you can really have the the technology to to preserve it and get it where you need to be, and then the know-how of the personnel to use it and all that. So it becomes this kind of convergence in the 1940s with all this know-how, this ability, the transportation nodes and all that to get it to where it needs to go. Because somebody giving blood today in Baltimore, if it's not used till a week from now in Normandy, you know, that could be a problem, couldn't it? So they know how to do this. And so the American public are doing that. And one of the things that you probably would have done on the home front as a woman, especially, is rolling bandages. That was considered to be a very kind of what women could do to help the war effort sort of thing. So a lot of housewives or actually wives of military personnel, that's a big part of what they're doing. Because, again, you know, bandaging becomes so important, and it's a very mundane thing, but it's easy to run out. And so you need somebody to prepare all of it. But the blood drives, I think, are really top of the line in terms of
fascinating.
Yeah.
And they're freezing it and shipping it within a matter of days. There's a constant stream of blood, basically.
To all the fighting fronts.
Going over the Atlantic and across the Pacific. That's absolutely amazing.
Has it been flown over, presumably?
It's being flown over. So much as you can do that. But some being shipped. So it's being melded then with what you're raising in theater, too. I should point that out, too, that if you served in a medical unit, there's a very good chance you would have donated blood probably many times during the war. Because that's where you're getting a lot of your blood too, is other service personnel, including a lot of the people who are with medical units who are just right there, you know? Flown, shipped, whatever, it's getting to where it needs to be. And it's saving so many lives. It's just, we'll never be able to calculate that.
God, and John, just before we finish, tell us about the corpsman. You know, is that one platoon? How does that work?
Yeah, typically. So even the terms were different. So the Marine Corps had no real medical infrastructure of its own. So it relied on the Navy for all medical support from the platoon level all the way up, you know, to division level and like hospital ships and whatever else. But so you would have a Navy corpsman, usually a pharmacist mate, who's attached to a Marine platoon. And so you'd have multiple corpsmen per company, say. And the joke, of course, since the Marine Corps famously hates the Navy or whatever, you know, it's part of the Navy. The only sailor you had any hope for or any regard for was the corpsman kind of thing, because he's your combat medic, you know. So in the Army.
Because I remember John Bradley was famously the flag raiser.
Well, and actually, believe it or not, he was not one of the flag raisers. But that's one of the things that's come out in recent years. But yeah, he was a Navy corpsman. And that was very typical. Okay. But he would have been right there in the sharp end. Oh, he's right there in the sharp end. And so as a Navy, if you go into the Navy in World War II or any period and they ask you to be a corpsman, you should have the scales drop from your eyes. Because what that really means is you're going to be with the Marines.
Yeah.
Almost certainly. And you're going to be very much at the ultimate sharp end of war. And the equivalent in the Army, because the Army obviously had its own medical infrastructure, was that often called either aid man or medic. You'd see both terms.
Oh, yes, and a medic.
Yeah, it's the same level, probably platoon level, maybe multiple guys per company. And you are right there with the infantry or whatever.
But so say you're in, I don't know, Company F of the 118th Infantry. Are you a medic in that unit?
Are
you in the...
You're attached.
So you're part of the United States Army Medical Corps.
By MOS you are. But the way this would work typically, like within a combat division, you would be a member of the medical detachment, which could be a battalion or a regimental asset, and you are attached then to the rifle company, F Company 118, or whatever it happens to be.
So what would the unit be called, say, attached to, I don't know, the 1st Infantry Division?
Well, you'd have the medical detachment, say. So you'd have the 1st Medical Battalion. That's part of our divisional medics.
And how many would be?
So, several hundred. And that's your basic medical infrastructure for the division. But believe you me, it's augmented by medical detachments of every subunit you could possibly imagine, plus attached medics from outside the division, the field hospitals, the general, all that structure. But in terms of what we've got individually in the Big Red One, they're probably coming from the 1st Medical Battalion. And so in the medical detachment, which is like a company-sized unit, in any regiment or battalion is parceling out those assets, whether it's the medical aid men slash medics to the rifle companies, or whether it's battalion surgeons and whatnot, if we have a battalion aid station, which we do.
So would the medic feel like he's a medical part of the medical detachment, or would he feel he's a company F kind of guy?
Probably the latter, if things are working the way they ought to be. Now, at the beginning of the war, he may be derided by the other soldiers, especially if he's a conscientious objector, as just a pill roller, as a, you know, cowardly guy who doesn't want to fight. As things go on, and we see that this guy is probably the most courageous person in the unit, because he's going out and saving lives while the rest of us are taking cover, he is revered. And so the dynamic, I think, is fascinating, because the medic, a successful combat medic, which most are held arguably in higher regard than anybody else in our combat unit, and really often has more sway in personnel decisions than the commander on some levels as to who's going to be evacuated, who's not. Any respected medic is going to have that sway. He's also going to be dealt with differently. We're not going to have him carry certain kinds of equipment. So we're not giving him extra ammo, for instance. Why? Because that means less medical supplies he can carry, and that could matter, right? So he's not going to go on certain patrols, maybe on any patrols. There's a really interesting, you guys have seen Band of Brothers, like every episode you probably know it inside out, like I do, like we're all nerds, right? Remember the episode where Doc Rowe, Shane Taylor's character is featured so prominently? And you remember how Sergeant Martin is about to take a group out on a combat patrol? And Doc Rowe is just sort of gravitating about to go along with the group. And Sergeant Martin stops him, takes him aside and says, "Hey, Doc, why don't you hang back here?" And I think that's really brilliant filmmaking, because it shows in that moment of film exactly the correct role that the medic would have had, and a grizzled infantry sergeant would have recognized. I don't need my medic right up there looking for trouble with the rest of us. I need him within striking distance in case something happens. That's exactly how you would have been treated.
And your medic would be a PFC or a corporal?
Probably a Tech 5. So equivalent to a corporal. If he had more rank, then he'd be Tech 4, Tech 3 as things go up. But the typical guy attached to a rifle company or a tank unit or whatever is a Tech 5. In the Navy and the Marines, in Navy, he's a pharmacist mate of some kind, you know, whether first, second class or whatever. So it's a lower ranking enlisted person. And they perform the same role that paramedics do, basically, in civilian life.
Oh, it's fascinating.
They're incredible.
Well, I'm glad we've had this conversation.
Yeah, another rabbit hole.
Yeah, among many, right?
I want to know more. I want to find out more. Oh, well, thanks, John. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We hope that's stirred your brain cells. We'll see you after the festive period, John, if not before. Have a very Merry Christmas.
And I think we'll see you before Christmas.
I think we will.
We'll see each other before then.
I just get this thing that basically the minute December starts, I think, well, that's it.
I know.
It's all over till mid-January. Exactly. Won't be able to get any sense out of like anybody.
You're in this nether world until then.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, well, we'll see you soon, John. Thanks for listening.
Have fun in New Orleans.
Yeah, have fun in New Orleans. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
See ya.